From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. Film historian Joseph McBride is my guest. He's the author of many books and films and screenplays. He's an educator. He's written about Orson Welles, Frank Capra, Billy Wilder, and lots of others. His latest book is John Ford. It's a great book to own and throw a little John Ford Film Festival at your house with this book in your hand. Rediscover classics and Stagecoach and The Quiet Man, and then read about them in the book. Joseph McBride, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Great to be with you, Gary.
Was that your plan, that this would be a book people would keep with them?
Oh, well, that is a good way to read a book about films, you know. And we cover my collaborator, Michael Wilmington, who unfortunately died last year. He and I wrote that book. And back in 69 and 1971, and then it came out in 74. But I've updated the book. We'll go into that. But we covered 14 key John Ford films in depth. So it's a really, you know, if you want to watch, say, Ford Apache or The Quiet Man or, you know, Searchers, see the film and then read the chapter. I think it'll enhance your understanding and maybe go back and see the film again. And but we tried, you know, Ford made so many films. He directed 136 features and shorts. It's a staggering career. Nobody else will ever have a career like that again. And plus, he made a lot of films in World War II that are not included in that total. But so we decided to focus on 14 that were really major films. We could have done some others too, but we stuck with that. And I've added chapters. We have a good overview chapter about his career, and I interviewed him in 1970, and I include that. I've expanded the interview text in the book because I cut it short in the original edition, but I've included the whole thing. It was kind of a...
So glad you did.
Yeah, it's funny and it's outrageous because he was in a really strange mood. He was almost impossible to interview, as people know. And I was 23 years old, my first interview in Hollywood. Can you imagine this curmudgeon? It's like that scene in The Fablemans where Spielberg goes to see him. It's very
I was going to ask you about that. And, did you find that scene to be accurate to you?
Yeah. He did a good job of David Lynch captured John Ford. You know, he captured the cantankerousness where he's sort of really kind of mean to this kid. But then at the end, there's this little moment where Spielberg, the Spielberg character, Sammy, pokes his head around the door and says, thank you. And Ford smiles at him. That was true to life because Ford, at the end of our interview, after giving me a hard time, he was very warm, you know, in his farewell. And I gave him a copy of a book I'd edited for the Wisconsin Film Society called Persistence of Vision. And I dedicated that to Ford, and he looked at it. He had to hold his glasses up and peer into the book like 1 inch from it. And he said, oh, that's sweet, which I thought was very nice. So I had a chance to glimpse the different sides of Ford. He was a very complex man. And for a future biographer, that was a great experience just to be with him, even though, you know, I was frustrated he wouldn't give straight answers to a lot of questions. But he did say some things that were pithy and wise along the way. And so I thought it was fun to include the whole text to show really what he was like if you were sitting in his office. It turned out to be the last day of his career, too, because I found out he kept asking his secretary, have you heard from the Italian gentleman yet? A gentleman from Italy, as he called. And Ford was very preoccupied. And then I didn't know what that was about. Until I did my biography searching for John Ford, I went through all of Ford's papers and I looked through the papers for that period. And it turned out Ford had not been able to make a feature in America for 5 years because his great film Seven Women flopped and the studios wouldn't let him direct another, which is tragic. But his good friend Woody Strode, who acted for him in various films, had become a star in Italian westerns. And he tried to set up a project for Ford to direct, and Ford was game. And he thought it was the call was going to come through, and it wasn't coming through. And he realized, this is it. My career is ending. And he was in a, as you'd expect, a very melancholy mood. And at the end of our interview, he retired. He announced his retirement. He said, I said, I'm sorry for asking some stupid questions. And he said, well, it's not the questions, but all you people ask the same questions, and I don't know how to answer them. He said, I'm just a hard-nosed, hard-working. And then there was this long pause. He said, ex-director. And it was very moving to hear that. And I
Right.
was stunned for him to announce his retirement in the interview.
With you.
I don't think I caused it, but I was there. And so I've added some other material to the book. I've done some updating that was necessary, but not much. I tried to keep the original style similar because it was a product of two young men who were passionate about Ford. But I added a long section on his silent work because we now have 27 of his silent films in whole or in part, and that's about 40% of his silent output. So I was able to write a more sort of comprehensive overview of what he was doing in the silent years than had been possible before. And then I added chapters on his Irishness and his view of race and his view of comedy. And these are the three things that are most controversial among people who don't like Ford. They single out, most people don't like him say, well, I don't like his comedy. It's crude and, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's integral to his view of the world. So I wrote these essays, and we have a lot more photographs in the book too. I had a lot of great frame enlargements, which are a joy to look at because these are the real moments that we're singling out for various reasons. And it's great to see the exact moment. You couldn't do that back in 1974 when the book came out.
Well, James McBride, I grew up in Southern California where there were a lot of movie theaters and revival movie theaters, and I just became a cinephile, instantly. I can't remember not watching old movies and scanning the TV guide each week for when movies were. But I wonder how a guy from Wisconsin got interested in the movie.
Well, the same way you did. I mean, Mike Wilmington and I, back in the 60s and 70s, well, we were fortunate in that I went to the University of Wisconsin, which was a very exciting school at the time politically and artistically. And we had 35 film societies, which is extraordinary. And I
Wow.
ran the oldest one, the Wisconsin Film Society. And I could bring films I wanted to see as long as I made a profit. So to make a profit, I would show a Fellini film or a Bergman film. And we sold season tickets. And then I would slip in John Ford's Wagon Master or Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole as a bonus, for they'd cost $10 to rent, whereas a Fellini's film would be $150, so I showed films that I wanted to see, and it was really a struggle getting to see all these films. But there are all these other film societies, and we had a film archive on the campus, which is great, is the United Artists 16 millimeter collection of Warner Brothers and RKO films, which is fabulous. But I had to go to Milwaukee and Chicago to see first run films. In those days, first run films were in the big cities, and then they within a month or two they'd go to the smaller towns. So Mike and I would get on the bus and go to Chicago and see 2001, the day it opened, et cetera. But we also, there was a great theater in Chicago called the Clark Theater in the Loop. They showed classic films, and we saw The Searchers there for the first time in 35, beautiful print. But I would even take a bus to some town and rent a hotel room so I could watch The Bells of St. Mary's on TV at 10:30 p.m.
That's right.
Because I wanted to write about it. But in Milwaukee, we'd scan TV Guide and you'd mark it up, and like if it was on at 2:30 in the morning, you'd try to watch it. And it was a struggle. And also to write about a film, you have to see it several times. So these films that we wrote about, not only to understand it, but to double check it, make sure the dialogue is accurately quoted and you get the plot straight and everything. And that took a lot of work. So much work went into this book. Now it's easy to see films with DVDs and Blu-ray, even though not everything is available, but and streaming, And it's also great now because you can stop and start the films and freeze the frames and study them. And I put a lot of frame enlargements, as I say, in this new book. You know, it doesn't mean that people are doing it, but you can more easily do it, you know. But back then, you know, it was a good time to start as a film scholar because film studies was in its infancy. There had been a few schools in America that studied film, like USC and NYU, but other schools were not getting with the program. We only had three film courses in Madison. I took them all. And so I had to create my own curriculum, and the university very kindly let me look at every film that came in, went to a certain facility, you know, from all the courses. And so every day I'd go there at 9 a.m. and I'd see what came in, and I would watch great classics. You know, in one day I'd see Intolerance and Potemkin and Triumph of the Will and, you know, the major films. And I'd come home to my rooming house and I'd say, I just saw two of the greatest films ever made. And they would scoff at me, but it was true.
Yeah.
And then at night I'd go to a film, and then I'd go home and work on my book on Orson Welles, and then my book on Ford. It was, you know, I created this curriculum, and it was wonderful. But you know, it took work, but it was fun. I was immersed in it. And then Mike was a really good actor at the University of Wisconsin. Mike Wilmington, my writing partner, and John Ford. And after I did my Welles book, I thought I'd like to do Ford because he became my favorite director. You know, and the reason was I had seen several of his films and I liked them, but in 1967, December, I went home for Christmas in Milwaukee and I saw Fort Apache on TV, and it knocked me out because it's a revisionist Western, pro-Indian, very pro Native American film, and it's based on Custer loosely. Ford tried to make a movie about Custer called Glory Hunter in the 1930s, and they wouldn't let him make it because he debunked Custer, you know. And Custer was portrayed as a great hero in other films, which is absurd.
They died with their boots on.
Yeah, they died with their boots on, which is well made, but, you know, it ludicrously turns him into a pro-Indian guy and everything. But Ford finally got to make Fort Apache when he was had an independent film to release, a film company that released films through RKO. And it's written by Frank Nugent, his first produced screenplay, great screenplay. And the two screenplays, I was teaching myself to write screenplays, and the two that really inspired me were Fort Apache, which is like a novel on film. It's really wonderful. A lot of characters. He deals with the social life of the fort, a lot of women interacting with men, and Native Americans treated with great respect, and a great story, wonderful dialogue. And the other one was Citizen Kane, which I you know, Herman Mankiewicz and Orson Welles. And so I studied those as my role models. And but when I was a kid, I saw a Western every day on TV at 4 o'clock in Milwaukee on a show called Foreman Tom's Jamboree. And then on Saturdays, I'd see a Western or a sci-fi film at the local theater. And that's what kids did back then. We all played cowboys and Indians too. And, you know, but I was a little guy and I was getting beaten up every day and bullied, and I was for the underdog instinctively, and translated to minority groups, and so I was for the Indians. And when I saw these films, I thought, why do these Indians get beaten all the time? What's going on? It just seemed to make no sense. And I began to yearn for a film in which the Indians won. And I remember one day I came home, and on Foreman Tom's Jamboree, I saw a film in which the Indians won, and I was ecstatic. I don't know what it was. It could have been Fort Apache, because very few films fit that category in the classic era. And not only do they win, they are the good guys. They are the moral leaders in the story. And John Wayne plays a character who is sympathetic to Indians, contrary to his cliche.
Factual, yeah.
Yeah, right. People. He's a very complex actor with a lot of different roles, but he plays a very thoughtful guy who tries to bring peace with the Indians, and then he you know, it's a complicated film, but a great film. Henry Fonda plays the Custer character, and he's terrific and chilling. So that launched me on my study of Ford. And then I thought, I'd like to do a critical study, but he's too big a subject for me at that point. So I thought I needed a collaborator. So I asked my friend Mike. Mike was a superb actor in Madison, and I directed him twice in The Zeus Story. He was brilliant in that production. And he also was in a film that I directed called Close But No Cigar, which was kind of a romantic chase silent film. And we were close friends. And then, so we spent like a year and a half talking intensively about Ford. And that what I did was I kind of assigned a chapter to him and a chapter to me. And then, you know, I would combine his work and I did the final drafting. And, but he was a brilliant writer. He had great insights into acting in particular. I learned a lot about acting from him. But, you know, two guys, two heads instead of one really helped that book because Ford is such a complex figure. I later wrote a biography on my own, but by then I was older and more mature. But, you know, I needed that thing. But I think it really stimulated, you know, and having good discussions and some disagreements really helped the book. On the other hand, we had certain films we couldn't agree on. He didn't like The Grapes of Wrath for some reason, which is a great film. So we could never agree on it, so we didn't write about that. They Were Expendable is another one I think is a great film. Today, that and Wagon Master are my two favorite Ford films. But Mike didn't like that one either. So we wrote I thought it was important to have it in the book, but we wrote a kind of a compromised version, which was not satisfactory. So in the book now, the new edition from University Press of Kentucky, I did rewrite the section extensively on They Were Expendable. I felt it was necessary. And Mike later, you know, he and I would see each other in LA a lot. And he had come around thinking, yeah, that's a great film. So he would approve, I'm sure, you know.
Well, you know, there's so many things I want to ask you that I'm making little notes as we talk, but I want to ask you about this. There have been stories about John Ford that maybe he wasn't the greatest person of all time.
Yeah.
Maybe his behavior toward women and his and so on. And we just talked about John Wayne there for a second, and he might have been, you know, his politics were a big part of who he was and his image. I remember when True Grit came out, which I thought was so great, and my mother said, oh, I can't stand watching that guy. And I thought, well, gee, I mean, why should that have anything to do with it? But then, you know, now I don't particularly want to see Mel Gibson, so I kind of understand it. But I wonder, you know, do you think that the off-screen lives of actors and filmmakers should influence the viewer?
Well, I know that Wayne is a handicap for certain people, and back then it was a problem because the Vietnam War was going on. He supported the war, and Ford supported the Vietnam War, even though I found a letter in his papers to an old friend in Maine in which he said, I don't know what we're fighting for over there, but he publicly supported it. You know, he had that schism of public and private, which was unfortunate. But it really hurt his image, and I knew that when Ford died, immediately the next day he'd be okay again. You know, that's what happens with controversial figures. But Wayne, I wrote an essay on why Wayne is my favorite actor. I just think he's a superb film actor. But I went to Monument Valley during my research, which is part of the Navajo reservation. And I interviewed Navajos about Ford and Wayne. And they all liked Ford a lot, but there was a young guy there. This was 1973, and he was 27. He had just got back from Vietnam. He was wearing his fatigue jacket with, you know, medals and insignias and stuff. And I said, what do you think of John Ford? And he said, is he the old guy with the eye patch? And I said, yeah. And he said, oh, he's okay. And then I said, what do you think of John Wayne? And his face kind of clouded over, and he said, you see that big mesa over there? And I said, yeah. And he said, if I hear that Wayne is coming back to make a film, I'm going to be up there with my M1 rifle from Vietnam and I'll pick him off.
Wow.
And I thought, wow, what a story that would be. Indian kills John Wayne. Could you imagine? Could you imagine the headlines? And it gave me a bit of a moral crisis that if I read that Wayne was going back to Monument Valley, would I alert him that he was going to get shot,
yeah,
or let history happen? And I never really resolved that in my mind, but fortunately he never went back. But I interviewed the Navajos. Thought Wayne was a great guy. He was their friend. He was very nice to work with, and actually, throughout his career, crews and actors all thought he was great to work with. And, but they were shocked by the Playboy interview he gave in 1971, where he it was outrageous. Where he said basically, the Indians had it coming because they wouldn't share their land with white people. I mean, that was the gist of what he said. And it was just appalling. And I mean, oh my God. But the Indians told me, they said, you know, we thought he was our friend and we were horrified by this interview, you know, and they were dismayed. And they had, you know, the older people had trouble reckoning with this. And, but he was a complicated figure, but, you know, I do believe that, you know, you can separate the art from the artist, because, I mean, Wayne was not particularly, I mean, he was kind of stupid in terms of political things, obviously, and not only more than stupid, he was bigoted, but, and he was involved in the blacklist and, you know, but as an actor, he was different. I mean, first of all, he had Ford and Hawks and Walsh, these people, you know, controlling his performances and bringing out the best in him. And they gave him roles that were complex, more than, like when he directed himself, his films were cartoonish, you know, the Green yeah. Berets and the Alamo, even though the Alamo is an interesting personal project, but it's Ford directed part of that, but, you know, it's not as good as a Ford film. But, you know, I mean, I try to separate the two because, you know, frankly, I mean, there's a huge conversation to be had on cancel culture and everything. I don't believe in that. Because every artist in the world and every human being, if you get right down to it, we all have things in our personalities that are objectionable or things that we're ashamed of. That's human nature. And nobody's perfect. And, you know, artists more than most people, I think, are troubled individuals. That's why they become artists. You know, it's like the grain of sand in the oyster. So if we had to rule out artists because they're offensive beliefs about something, we wouldn't have very many artists left. None of them is a saint, hardly. You know, even Jean Renoir, who was a saintly kind of figure, there's a biography of him that reveals that he was kind of cooperating with Vichy France for a while to try to stay in France. And it's sad yeah. to read about that stuff, but, Ford, I was dismayed to find when I did my biography that he had some anti-Semitic tendencies, that a couple of his screenwriters said that, and I was not sure, but I found some letters in his collection that had anti-Semitic comments by not only him, but his son and his wife, you know, and he kept it under wraps, and his behavior was good in that regard, but he had some biases, you know, and that was, it hurt me to read that because, you know, I mean, I had trouble writing that biography. It took 30 years. And in the early days, I really had great trouble reconciling this guy who I admired so much as a great artist. And yet he had some terrible personal traits. You know, he was cruel to his actors and cruel to his son and one thing or another, and had some complicated political beliefs. But a big change for me came with Abraham Polonsky, who was a great blacklisted writer, director, who I knew well, wonderful guy and very brilliant man. And I once called Ford conservative, and Abe said, no, you can't call him conservative. He can't be classified in that simple way. He was not one thing or another. And that was a key moment for me that helped unlock the mystery of Andrew Saris wrote a book called The John Ford Movie Mystery, and that was part of it. I wrote the book because, and I started in 71 with the biography after we finished the critical study, because I thought there was a lack of a good biography that made you understand this very enigmatic man who obfuscated his personality for self-protective reasons. For, you know, I go into that a lot, how he created his myth. You know, Olive Carey, who, an actress who knew him longer than anybody else that I interviewed, said he was a lion he was a pussycat in a lion's costume. She said he was really a sweet, lovable guy. He was a pussycat, but he had to portray himself as a tough lion. He did that partly to survive in Hollywood. If you're just a sweet, nice fellow, you get kicked around in Hollywood.
We'll walk all over you, yeah.
Yeah, he sustained a long, long career. But he took it to excess. He was rather sadistic toward Wayne and other people. But, you know, Abe's thing, observation helped me because I realized I shouldn't try to reconcile these sides of his personality. He had all these sides within him, and you couldn't reconcile them. And that's true of all of us, I think, when you dig down deep, that we're contradictory. You know, Walt Whitman has a great statement. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I'm large. I contain multitudes. And Ford was a national poet like Whitman. And America is a very contradictory country. Just open the newspaper every day. You'll see examples of that, that, you know, we can't solve our problem with violence. We can't solve our problem with race. And Ford was a national poet, and he made good films about our history, but they're imperfect. And my friend Jonathan Lethem, who's a good novelist, loves The Searchers, but he and I had a 3-hour talk about that film once, and we agreed that it's an incoherent text because it contradicts itself in different ways. But Ford deserves a lot of credit for going farther than he ever had before in terms of exploring race. And the chapter that Mike and I wrote on The Searchers was in Sight and Sound in 71, and that was our most influential piece. It suddenly made the film popular again. It was kind of forgotten and suddenly became hailed as a classic. But it's a film that doesn't make complete sense, but it has some very powerful scenes in it. And so we tried to make sense of that. But in the biography, I went further because I wanted to see where these sensitive, beautiful, intelligent films came from. How did they come from this rough, uncouth guy? But he told Hedda Hopper once, he said, don't let this get around. I pose as an illiterate. You know, it was a deliberate pose he put on, and the toughness. He would drive studio executives crazy, and they let him alone. It was a very clever strategy because one of them said you could never get a sane word out of him because he was, quote, a crazy Irishman. You know, it worked for him, but it made him a kind of a strange character that I had to try to understand.
I want to ask you about his filmmaking and why he does the things that he does. That is, you point out in your discussion, I was reading about The Quiet Man again the other day, and in there you point out how several of the frames, I don't know, the mise-en-scene or whatever, very deliberate, the like a painting. Or if you could picture Wayne following Claire Trevor down the corridor in Stagecoach, and he walks into that dimly lit corridor, he poses. Wayne kind of poses like a Greek statue on this, and then he walks into the light where he lights his cigarette. In what way does it enhance the storytelling to frame the film in this way, rather than just simply, okay, he walks down here, then he goes over here?
Well, you know, one of the things we concluded about Ford was he was painterly, and he had probably the best visual sense of any director. And he often didn't move his camera much, and so the frames tend to be somewhat static, but there's a lot of movement in the frames. And Spielberg has talked about how Ford's blocking is tremendous, you know, the way he moves people around from foreground to background, and behind people come from behind the camera and sides and all this, but he didn't believe in moving his camera. So the camera is a bit like a proscenium, but it's unobtrusively so. But he creates this sort of formal, beautiful frame, which says something about the world, that the world is harmonious. Robin Wood said Ford was the last of the great romantic artists because he saw a harmony between man and nature, and man and his environment. And in the modern world, people see a schism between man and humankind in their environment. But within the frame, there was a certain unruliness. And it's very important to Ford that he allowed the actors to be spontaneous, and he didn't like to rehearse scenes very much because he wanted the kind of roughness and spontaneity and mistakes that were made. He said, you know, Orson Welles echoed this, that the best things in movies happen by accident. So he would set up like an action scene. He wouldn't rehearse it so that it looked real, you know, it looked like if you see something happening on the street that's violent, it all looks very kind of chaotic. And but Ford controlled it. And I said, what if something happens that you didn't like? He said, well, we do it again, you know, like anybody. But there was a spontaneity within this formal frame. And that's very, very critical to Ford's view of life. And so there's, I mean, it has a lot of depth because there's a beauty to it, but there's a kind of roughness that is part of human nature that, you know, people are uncertain. And also Wayne's character is very strong. Obviously, Hawks told me Wayne was the strongest character on film, that he would blow everybody off the screen. But he's very vulnerable in Ford's films. He seems a little hesitant. And like, I was thinking when you mentioned the corridor scene, that's very expressionistic and beautiful in Stagecoach. His lighting was extraordinary. He once said, I can take an actress and put her in a corridor and have a little light playing on her, and I could create an emotion that way. And that's really true. He could do that with people. And that scene is so critical to Stagecoach. I frankly never really appreciated Stagecoach till I saw a good print at the Library of Congress, because the negative of that film was worn out from overuse. Yeah. And they had to make a new copy from John Wayne's personal nitrate print. And so the prints now, like on the Criterion disc, are beautiful. So and, but it is a film noir, and the lighting is so critical to understanding the meaning. He creates the meaning of Ford's films is not always in the dialogue, even though the dialogue is often really colorful and wonderful, but in the lighting and the mood and the movements. And Ford was asked, how do you watch a movie? He said, look at the eyes. He said, the secret is in the eyes, people's expressions and how they look at each other. And that's really true. And in, The Quiet Man, beautiful pictorial film, but raucous actions and charming spontaneity and people surprising each other, actors surprising each other, and he was a terrific director of actors. So that's one of the key facets of his visual style, which reflects his view of the world.
In Stagecoach, there's an action sequence with a stagecoach and Indians and Yakima Canet jumping around. And I wonder how much of that sequence is Ford and how much is second unit director, which I think was Yakima Canet on that picture.
Well, Canet actually, he was second unit director on, say, Ben-Hur, 1959.
Yeah.
58, 59. But he was a stuntman on, he was a stunt supervisor, and he did two of the greatest stunts in movie history in that sequence.
Yeah.
When he doubles Wayne and he jumps from the top of the stagecoach onto the horses, you know, the pairs of horses pulling the stagecoach at a high rate of speed, and he jumps onto their backs and he kind of waves and it cuts to a closer shot of Wayne, and then it's Canute again. And he falls off under the horses and the stagecoach passes over him. And Ford, somebody looked at Ford right after they shot that, and he was standing there, and he looked white as a sheet. He was just horrified by how dangerous it was. And the guy said, you want to shoot that again? Ford said, I'll never shoot that scene again. You know? But he also did another great stunt. He was amazing. But that scene was mostly Ford. You know, it was shot on salt flats, where Frank Capra later shot part of The Lost Horizon. And
yeah.
But there were inserts, and, you know, one reason I don't like Stagecoach as much as the later Westerns is that there were some process shots of people riding horses and going through Monument Valley. And to me, that disrupts from the reality of things. He didn't do that in later films.
They show up a lot better on that Criterion print than they used to.
They look good. I mean, it's beautifully shot by Burt Glennon, but, you know, he went to Monument Valley for only a week. It was the first film he shot there, and he didn't take any of the principal actors. So he did a lot of plates, you know, that he later put the actors in front of in the studio bouncing around. But he only took a few bit players with him, and then the Native Americans who he loved to work with. But, you know, Fort Apache and other films have the real actors on real horses, no process screens.
Well, we're talking with Joseph McBride, and his new book is a revised edition of his book, John Ford, and it's a fabulous book. But I'm keeping my eye on the clock because there's other things I want to ask you about. So, I once had Vincent Bugliosi on the show here, who was the prosecuting attorney in the Manson case, and he wrote a gigantic treatise on the JFK assassination. And he believed the Warren Commission was 100% correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that huge doorstopper of a book. No, yeah. he's totally blinkered on that case. You know, I mean, I worked for Kennedy in 1960, and I actually wrote a short story about Kennedy's assassination in October 1961 for my high school English class in Milwaukee.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because I was worried about his safety, having met him up close twice during the primary and once when he was president in 62. But I was aware of his vulnerability, and I was worried about him. And that made me write this short story that was kind of prescient, even though it's a juvenilia. But it became my life's work when he was killed. I mean, this was my candidate who I believed in, and he got murdered. And the government didn't solve the crime. That really shocked me at the time. And it educated me quickly about how we treat justice in America. I mean, for example, you're guilty until proven innocent, and the Constitution says it should be the other way around. And so I call it a four-day docudrama on television. I have a chapter in my book, Into the Nightmare, about Oswald being tried, convicted, arrested, tried, convicted, and executed all on live TV in 4 days. And that was, they tried to say, that's it. You know, this complicated case is all over. Actually,
do you believe that Oswald killed President Kennedy?
No, I don't think he killed Tippit or Kennedy. He wasn't involved in either crime. My Into the Nightmare is mostly about the Tippit case. Well, it's about two-thirds about the murder of Officer Tippit, which had not been investigated seriously before I did my book. And I advanced the case. I figured out what Tippit was doing in Oak Cliff. He was actually, I found out, hunting Oswald with another policeman named William Menzel. They were ordered to go into Oak Cliff, which is a suburb, and track down Oswald. And this was at least by 12:45, they were doing that. And so that means that there was a conspiracy right there, because Oswald's identity was supposedly not known to the police until 2:10, when he got to the police station after being arrested at the theater. But before 12:45 and onward, Tippit and Menzel were racing around Oak Cliff trying to find specifically Lee Harvey Oswald, and they knew his address. And the Dallas police had him under surveillance. And not only that, he was an FBI informant. He had met with the FBI at least three times in November of 63. And Henry Wade, the DA of Dallas County, interviewed him, and he said, you know, Oswald met with the FBI the day before the assassination. I said, really, the day before? And he said, well, maybe a day or two before. I mean, that was news. And he also met with them on November 16th and then about November 12th. And so I think he was an informant inside the school book depository, reporting to the FBI in the case, not realizing he was being set up as the patsy.
Do you think that President Kennedy was shot from the school book depository?
Yeah, it seems that there were at least three shooting locations: the school book depository, the Daltex building, which was behind him on a lower angle, and the grassy knoll. There was a triangulation of three shooters. Some people think there was a shooter on the south side of the street, but it was a crossfire, and he was hit by several bullets. And there were probably 8 or 10 bullets fired during this. The Secret Service agent in the front seat, Roy Kellerman, said a flurry of shots came into the car, you know. And then I found out that, and this is studied by a lot of people, the car stopped when Kennedy was shot for a few seconds so that they could do the kill shot. And he was hit in the head twice. And I interviewed Senator Ralph Yarborough, who was riding two cars behind, and he told me the car stopped, and he said Secret Servicemen were piling out of the car in front of me, running around the car. And that's not seen in the Zapruder film, which was altered that weekend to remove
the Zapruder film was altered.
Oh yeah, the CIA took it to their Hawkeye works in Rochester at the Kodak plant and altered the film that weekend to take out incriminating things like the car stop and the, you know, multiple agents running around the car. All we see now is one agent, Clint Hill, jumping on the back of the car, but there were others, and other witnesses reported that. So there are many anomalies, and I really studied this for Into the Nightmare came out in 2013. That was my big opus on my investigation of it. I structured it on how I investigated the murder of Kennedy and Tippit, and I did a lot on Kennedy too. But I also wrote a book last year called it came out in 2021. It was called Political Truth, the Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy. I'm very proud of that book because I'm a critic of the media, and I've been a journalist since 1960, professional journalist, and my parents were journalists. So I'm very aware of how the media have lied to us, the mainstream media like the New York Times and the Washington Post and CBS in particular, but it's the alternate media like podcasters and people who write books and people who make movies who've been telling us the truth and trying to really investigating the case. It's been left to private citizens to investigate it, which is actually kind of inspiring that a lot of people have done it for love of the subject, love of Kennedy. And I've done it because of loyalty to Kennedy, who I work for, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. When Mark Lane's book came out, I think that was maybe 67 or something, and people started to talk about conspiracy really for the first time, the conspiracy theory idea was kind of a left-wing political point of view. You know, there's question authority and that kind of thing.
Well,
and today it's very much a right-wing point of view, the conspiracy theory. How did that transition occur?
Well, I write about that question in the book a lot because that's a form of disinformation that in 1966, there's a CIA memo that was later declassified that told, they sent it to all their people in the field about how to counter the criticisms of the Warren Report. And they said, they talked about conspiracy theories. They didn't use that actual phrase, but they talked about countering conspiracy ideas, you know, and they introduced that whole concept into the bloodstream of the media. Before that, the words conspiracy theories were very rarely used, and suddenly it blossomed everywhere. And it's a way of shutting down discussion, you know, if you talk to people. You know, I've had many discussions over the years with my friends, usually baby boomers are the most reluctant to talk about it. The younger people, like when I talk to my students about it, they have an open mind, they're interested. But if you say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, that's supposed to shut down discussion because it's sort of code word for meaning you're a nut. But it also means you're a dissenter from the official line, which, you know, dissent should be allowed, and it isn't very encouraged in America. But what happened was they were stigmatizing people, and it wasn't exactly left-wing or right-wing at the time. It was just concerned citizens of different kinds who were studying. And actually, the public over the years has been very skeptical of the Warren Commission's simplistic version. One guy did it all, and they swept a lot under the rug. And about at the head of the Gallup polls said once that about 70% of the American public doesn't buy that consistently, you know, and it goes up and down a bit, but very soon.
Of course, a whole bunch of Americans today believe that there was, you know, vast fraud in the 2020 election.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's why conspiracy theories are given a bad aura, because they lump together all different kinds of things which are true and false. There are some, I mean, Watergate was a conspiracy.
Yes.
9/11, you know, like I, you know, when you talk to people who believe in the government version of 9/11, I say, well, you're a conspiracy theorist. And they say, what? What? And I said, well, don't you believe that 19 Arabs armed with box cutters brought down the World Trade Center and hit the Pentagon? And, oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's not a conspiracy. Somebody wrote a book on conspiracies, and he actually said, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's true, which is really specious logic.
No, I mean, it could still be a conspiracy. But do you believe that in the case of 9/11, you know, the government of George W. Bush knew what was happening, and there were bombs planted that brought down the buildings and so on.
Well, there are many, many anomalies in that story that, you know, Gore Vidal said the smoking gun in that story is that the air defense system in the United States was down that day, which shouldn't happen. And it's, you know, we have this very sophisticated air defense system we spend billions on, and it mysteriously was down that day, and they had five drills going on that day too, which confused the air traffic controllers. And one of them says on the tape, is this real world or exercise? Like they didn't know what was going on. So the commission, again, I mean, what I tell students in my class, and I write this in Political Truth, that all the important events in American history since 1960, the official story doesn't make any sense, you know, like the 19 guys with box cutters, for example, all the cameras just happened to fail in the airports and none of them are recorded getting on the planes. Not one of those 19 people is on the manifest of the planes, which is very bizarre. And, you know, the hole in Pennsylvania where the plane was supposed to have crashed is a tiny little hole. And the rescue people found no bodies and no wreckage at the supposed crash site, but wreckage was strewn over about 8 miles of that. So we apparently shot down that plane, and that's what a lot of people in the government thought was happening that day. We shot down that plane. But so they made up a story that the passengers took over the plane and it crashed in a field. But, you know, read what the police chief said and the fire chief. There's nothing there. We went there and there was nothing there. So that's a case that hasn't been studied properly. But, you know, you look at since 1960, what are the big events in American history? The Vietnam War, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, Iran-Contra, Gulf War, 9/11, you know, et cetera. The two big wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. None of the
officials. Yeah, you would have to say the January 6th.
January 6th, of course. Yeah. I write about January 6th a lot in my book, Political Truth, because I think that's a logical end result of the Kennedy assassination. Because, you know, when you talk about the right wing latching on to conspiracy theories, there's been so much government lying about the Kennedy assassination that I think that started the disbelief in the government. Because I remember as a kid trusting the government, and you probably do too, and the polls show that like 80-90% of the people believed whatever the government told them. And, you know, they didn't always tell the truth. There are a lot of lies in American history, but, yeah, we tended to believe it rightly or wrongly. And then our belief was shattered by that. In Vietnam, they had what they called the credibility gap, because Johnson was lying to the public. He didn't want to admit what he was doing in Vietnam. And then we found out, and people were horrified. And but over the years, that's bred a kind of a knee-jerk lack of belief in official stories. And then Reagan, I think, delegitimized government. He was the guy who really led that crusade. The government is your enemy, you know. And so we see the results when a charlatan like Trump says, you know, the election was stolen. Go attack the Capitol. They do that, which is, you know, a coup attempt that failed, whereas the Kennedy assassination was a coup attempt that succeeded. So I write about that progression in my book, and Political Truth. I worked on that for a long time too, but over the years I realized this is still a big problem in America. And so yeah. Conspiracy thinking is a complex subject that we shouldn't rule out alternate views of history, but we should study carefully the facts behind all these events. And when I teach students about the media, I teach them to be very aware of the media as consumers of the media. Don't believe anything you hear in the media. Study it for yourself. You have to look into the, you know, I mean, frankly, you have to look at documents, which sometimes come out years later. You have to go interview people. You have to study.
You'd have to get into Donald Trump's bathroom to see those documents.
Yeah, he's got them all. Well, they were pretty easy to access. Apparently, if you were at Mar-a-Lago, you could go and take a look at them, right? Which is outrageous. That's another, you know, nuclear secret sitting in the ballroom down there. You know, I mean, crazy. But, you know, just to bring it back to John Ford briefly, yeah. The man who shot Liberty Valance came out in 1962. And I think it prefigured the Kennedy assassination in the sense that artists are kind of like the canaries in the coal mine. They're onto things that are going to happen. And in Liberty Valance, it's a film about how the wrong man is publicly credited with killing an outlaw. And the public is fooled, and it happens from shadowy alleyway where Jimmy Stewart is ostensibly shooting Liberty Valance and John Wayne is in the shadows and with Woody Strode. And so it's this kind of grassy knoll kind of situation.
The press is to blame. Print the legend.
Yeah, the press has told the truth. This happens a lot. Jimmy Stewart feels guilty and he tells the newspaper editor and the guy rips up the story and throws it in the fire. And I've seen this happen a lot. I mean, I went to the New York Times once with a story that was well documented and they wouldn't even look at the documents, you know. But that was, well, it's a long story, but Ford was onto that. And also the same year he did the Civil War section of How the West Was Won, which is about an attempt by a Confederate deserter to kill Ulysses S. Grant, who was a future president. And this
young, another assassination.
He's the leading general and this guy's going to kill him. And this young Union soldier who has befriended the Confederates kills the young man. So Ford was onto this kind of thing. He was a great chronicler of history. And I remember somebody who didn't like Liberty Valance at the time it came out, which is, you know, it's one of the all-time great films, but it didn't get good reviews. Somebody said, well, this film reminds us of Mao Zedong, who wrote, political power comes out of the barrel of a gun, which is a horrible, terrible, brutal thing to say. Well, hey, you know, he was right, because a year later, political power came out of the barrel of a gun. Killed our president and changed history, because 2 days later, secretly, Lyndon Johnson reversed the Kennedy policy of withdrawal from Vietnam, and he expanded the war secretly, and we weren't allowed to know that. He said he was going to, he put out a presidential secret order to take the war to North Vietnam and to expand the war. Kennedy had already withdrawn 1,000 troops that fall, and he was planning to withdraw everybody within a year or so. And but, you know, I go into the history. If you look at the New York Times, they report that, Johnson is just following Kennedy's policy in Vietnam. We were lied to about it. The press was fooled in that case, but they didn't really do their job properly either.
I do have a million more questions. In How the West Was Won, for instance, I read that Ford had absolutely no respect for the Cinerama camera, and he broke every Cinerama rule.
Yeah, he, you know, back in those days, they had three panels. That's the way they had to show the film. It was this curved screen.
I saw it that way.
Yeah, you saw it, and so unfortunately, the you know, you saw it with these weird panels. But what Ford did was he found ways of having like panels of buildings right where the joints were. They've removed them. I normally don't approve of altering old films, but I think in that case, in the Blu-ray and all that, they've taken out the panels, and that's fine. It looks super, super widescreen. But, you know, one of the myths about Ford was he was aesthetically conservative. But in fact, even though he complained about the widescreen, he used the super widescreen really well in Cinerama and Panavision. And when he shifted to color, he used color really well. And, you know, I mean, he was willing to go with innovations. But yeah, that film is a spectacular film. But Ford's Civil War section is by far the best part of the film. You know, it's great. Yeah, Jean-Marie Straub, the Danish filmmaker, said that segment was Ford's masterpiece. I wouldn't go that far, but it is a beautiful. It's amazing. I love the title when it says "The Civil War Directed by John Ford" at the beginning of the film. He encapsulates it in this personal story that's about 22 minutes long, and it's really a masterpiece of short storytelling.
Well, there's so much to talk about, Joseph McBride, and I want to thank you so much for spending a little time with us on From the Bookshelf, and I want to remind people about your new book. It's called John Ford, and also last year, Political Truth, the Media, and the Assassination of President Kennedy. So much great stuff to read and talk about. Will you please come back and be my guest again soon?
Oh, anytime, Gary. It's really stimulating to talk to you. Thank you for all your good questions and for delving into various historical topics. You know, Ford was a great historian of American culture, kind of like Shakespeare with his history plays. And he was examining our myths and realities like Shakespeare. He was our Shakespeare, in effect. And that's part of what makes him fascinating to me. So I do hope people read the new edition of the book. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.